The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
Cloudy skies. Welcome to this Thursday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up in just a moment, Goodwill of North Georgia President and CEO Keith Parker explains the decision to reopen thrift stores, donation centers, and career centers.
So we have ambassadors at the front door who monitor folks as they come in and meter the number of people who can come in a store at any one time.
That conversation coming up in just a moment. But first, as of 9 a.m. today, there are 35,793 confirmed COVID-19 cases. The number of deaths statewide is reported to be 1,523. There are 6,320 hospitalized. That's all according to the Georgia Department of Public Health, again, as of 9 a.m. earlier today. In related news, free COVID-19 testing is available this afternoon at the Marquette restaurant on Joseph E. Boone Boulevard. Now, as of right now, you just got a little bit on an hour to get there. Drive-through and walk-up testing will take place until 2 p.m. And those seeking tests should make an appointment ahead of time. The event is sponsored by Atlanta City Councilmember Antonio Brown and the Family Health Centers of Georgia. In other news, one of the two suspects in the shooting death of Ahmaud Arbery now has legal counsel. Gregory McMichael will be represented by two Macon defense attorneys, Laura and Franklin Hogue. Gregory and his son, Travis McMichael, are currently jailed on charges of felony murder and aggravated assault. In a statement, Franklin Hogue said, quote, "The full story to be revealed in time will tell the truth about this case," close quote. The Hogues say they will soon schedule a preliminary hearing and they will petition the court to set bail. And finally, Zoo Atlanta is ready to reopen this Saturday. In a press release, the zoo experience will now include a, quote, time ticketing system to control capacity and limit the number of guests inside the zoo. Also, a one-way experience to reinforce social distancing guidelines. Closer Look has reached out to Zoo Atlanta officials to appear on the program tomorrow for more details. This is Closer Look. This is Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. We're fundraising today because we need your help to keep WABE going strong. But don't go anywhere right now because this break will be short, I promise. Please help if you can at wabe.org/donate. And joining me is the woman responsible for our wonderful coffee conversation mugs, WABE's marketing director, Jayanne Berry.
Hi, that's wabe.org/donate or call 678-553-9090. We need your financial support right now because it helps pay for Closer Look. And today we're partnering with St. Vincent de Paul, Georgia. Your one donation means a low-income essential worker will receive a week's worth of transportation assistance. So please make a donation right now at wabe.org/donate or by calling 678-553-9090.
That's wabe.org/donate. Thanks to all the listeners who've already made a financial gift to WABE. Listeners like Catherine Schneider in Kennesaw. She says, I'm going to quote because I'm a journalist, quote, "It is so reassuring to listen to your station and hear the news from experts. Keep up the good work and stay safe," close quote. Thanks to you, Catherine, for your message and for your support. Her donation makes this all possible, but we still need to hear from you. If you can afford to give, please do so at wabe.org/donate.
Or call 678-553-9090. If you're able to make a contribution of $1,200 or more, you'll become a Cornerstone member. That allows you special access to WABE events, and you'll make a big impact on the quality of programming for our community. Please give if you can at the Cornerstone level. That breaks down to $100 a month. Go to wabe.org/donate or call 678-553-9090.
Closer Look returns in about 30 seconds. Thanks for your help. Please give at 678-553-9090. And as always, thank you.
It only takes a couple of minutes to give. And while we'd love for you to become a Cornerstone member at $100 a month, the average gift is $15 a month. So please give what you can afford. Just go to wabe.org/donate or call 678-553-9090. And thanks.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. As of this broadcast, one of the oldest nonprofits in the state of Georgia will reopen all of its remaining store locations. I'm talking about Goodwill of North Georgia, which last week announced it was going to reopen 21 of its 65 stores, as well as four of its 13 career centers, which are so important. This was all part of their phase reopening strategy. Joining me now to talk about all of this is Keith Parker, President and CEO of Goodwill of North Georgia. Keith, as always, good to talk to you.
Love being here with you, Rose. Hope you're doing well.
Hanging in there. Let's talk about the phasing in all of this and the strategy behind it. Was this a collective effort in determining how you all would reopen and coming up with this phase reopening strategy?
Yes. Rose, we tried to do a phase reopening because we wanted to keep our customers and our employees as safe as possible. So, you know, we have been shut down for almost 2 months. And we've been strategizing the entire time about what's the right way to reengage. So our strategy ended up being, let's reopen in our more rural areas to get started, where we have lower volume stores and areas that, and in fact, in many areas that don't have as many confirmed cases of COVID-19. And so we selectively picked those stores to test a few things. One, to see first would all of our employees come back. And we got a resounding yes to that. We have not laid off anybody and kept everybody in full work status. And then two, we wanted to see how our customers would respond to the social distancing and other requirements that we're having now as we reopen. And in both those instances, things have worked out just extraordinarily well. The customers have really adhered to any and every request we've made. And we've had very good sales to get us started. So we're viewing that first week of phased openings a huge success. And then today, starting at 10 o'clock today, we reopened the remaining stores. So we started with 20 last week and reopened 45 more today. And all are now underway. Some have some significant lines already at the door. But so far, so good in terms of how people are responding. There's a lot of pent-up demand. You know, we have literally tens of thousands of donations that have come in. And so we have some outstanding stuff that that people are buying and getting some great deals on.
So, Keith, I want to back up for a moment because you mentioned opening up in the rural areas. And for someone listening, they said, well, that makes sense. But now here in the Atlanta area, Gwinnett, DeKalb, and Fulton has the highest number of confirmed cases in the state. Did you all consider all that? And with those stores, with those donation centers and stores and career centers in those counties, what concerns do you have? And can you understand someone saying, well, maybe in these areas, y'all should have waited a little bit?
Well, that's an excellent question and something we certainly considered. But effectively, what we've done is what Home Depot, Publix, Target, Walmart have been doing for the last 2 months. And that is, we've opened, but we're opening with significant guidelines to keep our employees and our customers safe. So we have ambassadors at the front door of every one of our facilities who monitor folks as they come in and meter the number of people who can come in a store at any one time. Mm-hmm. Now, in the past, you know, we have big stores among Goodwill. We're amongst the largest network of Goodwill in the footprint of our stores, typically a bit bigger than what you'll see around the country. But we have first looked at what the state guidelines were per the amount of square foot we are supposed to have per customer, and we've exceeded that. So in other words, we've given each customer even more space. Mm-hmm. And we have multiple sales associates inside the stores to make sure that people don't bunch up amongst each other. Our lines inside the stores are one way, so that once you go into an aisle, you have to keep going in that same direction so as to avoid people crossing one another in the aisles. We've actually shut down the water fountains and some other areas, even the dressing rooms, where there are high-touch types mm-hmm. of opportunities, so that people will not find themselves bunched up again with a number of different folks. We even took the added step of we've got some great disinfectant cleaners. And so before we opened up any of the stores, we went through as a final step and cleansed every single square inch of both the front and the backs of our stores, all the clothing, everything. So it actually has a great sort of like a new car smell to all of our Goodwill stores right now. We have taken enormous precautions.
Well, in terms of the precautions, let's talk about your customers. Are you all requiring folks to enter with a mask at least?
We didn't make it a requirement, but we have a huge sign on the front of the door requesting it. And I'd say, in fact, I just got a note before we went on air from my vice president of donated goods retail, and he said 98% are wearing that mask voluntarily. Mm-hmm. So overwhelmingly, that's what people are doing. What we don't want to do is create any situation where we put our employee in conflict with the customer. So if a customer is adamant about not wearing a mask, we don't want our employee to become suddenly law enforcement, if you will. We don't want to put him or her in that position. But what we're finding, again, from our customers is they are adhering to all the requirements we're putting out there and keeping each other and themselves safe.
Okay, Keith, let's move to an area that obviously, which is what you told me a long time ago why you took this job, was being able to service people that maybe prior in their life there might have been some barriers or challenges. For the folks who you all employ, a lot of them are veterans, people with disabilities, people who are trying to rebuild their lives. So as you all made this phased decision to reopen, it's going to impact a lot of those folks who are working for you all.
We did a few things that we wanted to make sure as this pandemic hit. You know, the number one workforce development nonprofit in the state, we wanted to set an example. So we have not laid off a single person at Goodwill of North Georgia who didn't voluntarily want to do it. Some people literally just said they didn't want to work, and so they would prefer to not work during this time period. And it hasn't been many, just a handful. Mm-hmm. Overwhelmingly, our folks, we've kept as whole as we possibly could. Anybody who was full-time before this started, they're full-time now. Anybody who had health benefits, they have health benefits now. And the strategy on that was twofold. First, we wanted to do it because we want to protect our folks, but also, like right now, when we're ready to reopen, the callback rate that we've had, when we've called our folks to come back to work, has been incredible. When I've talked to other people who had to lay off their folks for a while or furlough their folks for a while, they've had a much more difficult time getting their employees back into work mode. So it's worked very, very well for us. And it's not to besmirch anybody else about how they've done it, but how we've approached it. We wanted to really take care of our people. We think it builds loyalty. We think it helps us from a seamlessness standpoint. Because we know if we lay people off, then have to bring them back and then re-drug test them and then get them retrained and all those things, all that's cumbersome. And we wanted to be able to right away open safely and do it with causing as little harm to our employee base as possible. And again, so far the results have been very, very good.
Well, then let's move to the career centers, which are so important. You have about 13 of them. So your career centers are open as well.
Yes, so we've opened up all of our physical career centers, as well as we never really stopped on the virtual career center. And what I mean by virtual, you can go on our website, careerconnector.org, and get an enormous amount of services. In fact, that's where we saw the huge bump when we did have to physically shut down some of our career centers during the pandemic. And we also recognize that quite a few of the folks who come in and need our help, whether it's through computer services or a whole host of other things, that some may not actually have adequate internet connections in their home. So mm-hmm. we've actually worked out a deal with a provider to provide either low cost or no cost internet connectivity for them in their home. So we try to look at every part of the bases. You know, we're going to cover every base that could prevent a person from being successful in their job search, and then jump right in. And Rose, if I may, the numbers are staggering in terms of the need that's out there. You know, we've been looking at some of the numbers produced by the Atlanta Regional Commission and others. And, you know, the two hardest hit areas, interestingly, have been Gwinnett and then South Atlanta, you know, south of I-20. So some of the projections are unemployment rates that could be in the 22 to 30% range. You know, already we see that it could be $1.5 billion in lost compensation per month, $1.5 billion per month. And this is early on. This is before what people think will be another wave of unemployment that's coming. So that's $5 billion. That translates into $5 billion in lost sales per month for all the various retailers and others who are out there. So we take that very seriously. And we're looking not just at what we try to do immediately to help people find work, but we're looking to the future, what the post-COVID-19 workforce will look like, what their needs will be. So we're strategizing and planning for that now. So it's a lot to take in, but we want to stress to folks, shop at our stores, donate to us, because from those donations and your shopping, that generates profits for us that we then turn into workforce development, to put people to work and get them into a career that's sustainable for them and their family.
The voice here is Keith Parker, President and CEO of Goodwill of North Georgia, and we're talking about the organization's phase reopening strategy and moving forward. Well, Keith, were you all able to help folks even find employment during when the most businesses were shut down?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the hardest hit areas have been, of course, you know, right here in our hometown, Delta Airlines. The airline industry has been extremely hard hit. Oh, just overall travel and tourism has just been really, really hit. Of course, retail, all those places hit hard. But what we have seen is you know, some surging opportunities in wholesale trades. Couriers and people who are out there as messengers and so forth, warehouse storage. So even during this period, we've been able to work directly with employers like Walmart, Target, Publix, Kroger, and then at a huge level, Amazon, helping those folks find great positions. Mm-hmm. So some of our folks, you know, we've been able to actually help them improve their lives. So a typical person who may have come onto our careerconnected.org site may have been working a $9-$10 buck an hour retail job. We've been able to place some of those folks directly with an Amazon, where the starting wage is $17 an hour. So some have really benefited from this opportunity, you know, a crisis turning into an opportunity. And yes, we've serviced more than 4,000 people on our website during this time period and finding many of them positions. And we know this is just the beginning, because it's going to be a long, long haul here. We're seeing a bit of the level of demand isn't through the roof in terms of people banging down the doors at the career centers yet. In part, we think because the unemployment benefits are still in place. Mm-hmm. But come July, when many of the folks who will have been on unemployment for 2, 3, 4 months, and those benefits begin to come to an end, we're preparing for that upsurge of people who we know will be coming through the doors.
Well, Keith, speaking of upsurge, and we're not sure if Georgia will see an increase in confirmed COVID-19 cases. We're not sure if there will be a spike. What will you all follow in terms of if you need to make a decision to go back and close stores?
Absolutely. You know, we talk about it literally every single day. I had a meeting just yesterday where one of our committee meetings with some of our board members and some staff folks, and we have been strategizing what happens if the second wave of closings occur. It's tough to stay in business, to pay lease payments like we have, mortgage payments like we have, keep people employed, all those things with no revenue coming in. And no business can do that for too long a period of time. But we're looking at ways that we can keep ourselves sustainable as long as we possibly can. And we will continue to follow the primary things that we did as the pandemic when it first hit. Health and safety of our employees, our customers, and our community, first and foremost. Second, we want to continue as best as we possibly can to provide mission services. And for us, our mission, again, is to keep people working, put people back to work as best as we possibly can, and then do as little harm long-term to our employees. So those will continue to be our guides. We will follow the CDC recommendations. We'll follow the statewide guidance and so forth. But no one knows, and that's the precarious thing that we're in right now. We're all hopeful. We keep our fingers crossed that what we've seen is the peak or the plateau, and we'll begin to see things begin to subside. But we will not be naive, and we will not put our folks in harm's way as best as we possibly can.
And for those businesses that might want to reach out to the Goodwill of North Georgia or want to partner and say, hey, we have job openings, are you all vetting them in terms of their safety and their safety procedures for employees?
We absolutely have a lot of thorough conversations with our folks. Particularly, what we try to do is put the information in the hands of the job applicant. Mm-hmm. So we tell them, here's what the work environment is going to be like. Here's what the hours are going to be like. Because what we don't want to do, the last thing we want to do is put all the effort in, all the resources for a placement, and then the person quits 2 weeks later, mm-hmm. or even 2 months later. We really want to create situations where it's a win-win for the applicant and then for the company that he or she is going to. So we want that applicant to be fully aware of what's involved. And then we empower them to make their decision. If we have major concerns with the employer, we certainly talk that through. Just like we try to make placements that work. So mm-hmm. if a person has a criminal background, violence or things like that, we're not going to tell that person, hey, look, we're going to try to place you in a daycare. We're not going to do that. But if a person has medical conditions underlying, and we try to get that out of them when we talk to them, not to get into their business, but for the very reason what you were just mentioning, we want to keep them safe and make them successful. We don't want a person with underlying physical or mental issues mm-hmm. that would put them in harm's way or their coworkers in harm's way as we try to place them. So we keep all those things in a very trusting way. Our career counselors have been doing this for a long time. We have a no judgment type of mentality. When you walk through the door, we welcome you. We pat you on the back virtually now or from a distance. But they know that they're going to get the very best from us in terms of giving them as best information as we can to place them in a place that they're going to be successful and not put them in a situation where they're jeopardized.
And Keith, as we wrap up, just once again, someone listening saying, okay, that's great. Y'all are hiring. What do I need to do?
So definitely come to goodwillng.org. That's goodwillofnorthgeorgia.org. That's our website. And from there, everything is pretty self-explanatory, because from there you can connect with one of our career counselors. From there you can get direct information about how we're hiring. We're still hiring a few people mm-hmm. in our stores and throughout several of our territory. And you can learn all the different ways to work with Goodwill. If you're an employer who needs some help with finding great people, let us know. And if you're an employer who has to make the very difficult decision to lay people off or to terminate someone's employment, contact us as well on that, because we want to make that transition from them being unemployed to being employed and moving into other great opportunities as seamless as possible. And that's what we're here for.
And Keith, give that website again one more time.
It's GoodwillNG, like North Georgia, GoodwillNG.org.
Great. Now, Keith, a lot of folks, we've all taken this time to clean out our attics and basements, and we got a lot of stuff, but I noticed that you all said, look, we have a lot of inventory right now, so you're not accepting donations again until, what, May 18th?
Yeah, just a few days until the 18th. Just leave it in your trunk. We've made donating extraordinarily safe. We completely revamped our donation process. So now we suggest you simply put everything you want to donate to us in your trunk mm-hmm. or in the back of your SUV. Drive up to one of our attended donation centers, our stores, any of those places, and never get out of the car. Don't even roll down your window. Just pop the trunk. Our folks will take it out completely, leave your receipt in the car for you so that you can then itemize for your taxes, tax purposes, just to get a receipt to remind yourself of what you've dropped off, for completely contactless donation. And that's what we are really stressing, because we want to keep you safe, keep our customers safe. We have a mountain of donations, of incredible stuff I mean, just incredible.
I'm still looking for bookcases, and I need a file cabinet, so.
We got them. Come see us. Our stores are loaded, and they're spotless. Our customers are so eager to help people. And then come Monday, drop your donations off, and we're back to normal.
And Keith, I know that you are an executive. You take leadership very seriously. I've been in the stores with you. Have you made your rounds? Have you been able to go out into some of the stores and career centers and personally see and feel that you all were ready to make this decision?
Oh, my gosh, yes. We have been doing that nonstop for weeks. Our team is so excited about having customers back in the store. You know, one of the fascinating things going through this process, our employees, many of them are, you know, folks who, like much of society, is pretty fragile, you know, week to week. Not a lot of savings, not a lot of resources to just fall back on. And what they told me loud and clear was, you know, first, keep us safe. So if it's not safe for us to open, don't. But then once it is, get us back to work. I mean, that's what we've been hearing. And that's why our, like right now, Rose, while other employers are literally hovering around 30, 40% of retaining their people during this period, we're over 90%. You know, some of our hardest working people working over at the CDC, working at the RS buildings and places like that, cleaning up, you know, doing some of the custodial work and so forth. 94% of those folks are coming to work every day. 94%. That tells you the level of commitment that our people have. So if 94% of the folks are coming to work to do things like clean up bathrooms, clean up some of these high trafficked areas in the CDC and so forth, definitely our retail people are excited about coming back as well. So we're thrilled. They're glad to get back to work. They want to see customers, and they're doing it because they know what our mission is. They know that by them coming to work, helping to facilitate the sale of this lightly used merchandise and clothing that people have, that it's helping others find their dream job, helping others move from the unemployment rolls to the world of the employed, and helping change communities. All these things are happening right under the roof of Goodwill of North Georgia.
Keith Parker, President and CEO of Goodwill of North Georgia. Keith, as always, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Rose, I'm always glad to be with you. You stay safe. Take care of you and yours.
I will. You too. This is Closer Look. I am Rose Scott, and we're fundraising today, but we're keeping these breaks very short to get you right back to the program. Please help if you can at wabe.org/donate. Joining me is Jayanne Berry, WABE's Marketing Director.
Hi, that's wabe.org/donate or call 678-553-9090. Now, your donation helps us bring you the latest news about the coronavirus, the 2020 election, the Ahmaud Arbery murder investigation, and so much more. Today, we're partnering with St. Vincent de Paul, Georgia, to help low-income essential workers. So every donation we get today from listeners like you will pay for a week's worth of transportation assistance for an essential worker. It's so important right now. So to make that happen, give right now at wabe.org/donate.
So yes, go ahead, give now at wabe.org/donate. or by calling 678-553-9090. Closer Look is always here for you. Every day, we bring you great interviews and allow you to connect with the rest of the Atlanta community. You rely on us. Now we're relying on you to make a donation. Please give right now at wabe.org/donate.
Or call 678-553-9090. We need your donation because 84% of our funding comes from the Atlanta community. Many of our listeners make that possible by giving $15 a month. So for you, please give what you can afford. Do that at wabe.org/donate or with a call to 678-553-9090.
So Closer Look is just about 30 seconds away. Thank you so much to everyone who's already helped us. Now it's time to hear from you. Please donate at 678-553-9090.
Or at wabe.org/donate. It only takes a couple of minutes to give, I promise. And if you're already a sustaining member of WABE, please consider giving an additional gift if you can. It'll really help us during these challenging times. Make your donation by calling 678-553-9090 or go to wabe.org/donate. Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. This is Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Another round of funding is coming from Congress. That's a simple way of describing another COVID-19 economic relief proposal. Now, this bill has an acronym, HEROES, or Health and Economic Recovery Omnibus Emergency Solutions Act, or you can just say HEROES. And it will include small business benefits. Now, you may recall, as of last week, the federal government has provided more than $500 billion in loans to small businesses through the Paycheck Protection Program. Still, as we've heard on this program, some small business owners are still experiencing challenges navigating through the whole process.
It's extremely scary situation, and many people don't realize how it affects small business, how it affects minorities also. When you take a building like ours that have so much equity in it, the mortgage companies stand to win if they step in to take our particular property. So we don't know how much longer we can continue down this road.
Did you all apply for any funding relief at all?
We did. We applied for everything. We applied for the disaster relief. It's like a black hole. You fill it out online and you don't know what happens after that. There's no one to call and talk to directly about it. We're originally told that we would get an answer within 7 weeks. We call SBA back, that turned into 2 weeks, then 3 weeks, and now 4 weeks, and we still don't have an answer. We don't know how they're selecting anyone when it comes to that. So the next step was let us fill out the PPP program. Mm-hmm. And that caused some challenges also, because in our industry, 80% of the workers are 1099. So therefore that cut out most of our employees from our ability to be able to help them with the PPP program. And right now, we're still waiting on the answer to that from one bank.
Now, that was Omar Ali, a local property manager and developer, sharing his experience just a few weeks ago here on Closer Look. Well, now comes a new report from the Small Business Administration's Inspector General released last week. It does align with what many small business owners have suspected. Lenders have not been distributing funds as intended. And joining me now from Durham, North Carolina, to discuss this is Yasmin Ferrari. She's a senior policy counsel for the Center for Responsible Lending, a Durham-based nonprofit policy group. Yasmin, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Before we get into this new report, I want to begin with the latest funding proposal. Now, it's just come out. It's very lengthy at 1,800 plus pages. But I take you all will probably have some of the same concerns from the first funding package. Now, this one is supposed to include a few changes to the PPP, which would include extending coverage to the end of the year. But beyond that, you all obviously had some concerns with this first funding package.
Yes, we did. And you're right. We have not had time to fully analyze those 1,800 pages, but we are working on an analysis of that. But to get back to the first program, the initial round of funding, and now there have been two rounds, we want to talk a little bit about the issues with the first program and the structural disadvantages that really made it so that small businesses of color were unable to access the program the way that we would like and would expect. So one issue with the first program, and I just want to make this point, is that no matter what happens in the upcoming programs, and we can talk about recommendations for the future, what we're recommending, and also, you know, what we hope to see in HEROES, is that for a lot of these businesses, getting access to that the program early on in this crisis was crucial. So, you know, being able to, when you're a really small business, access let's say $10,000 can make the difference between staying afloat and not. And so getting $10,000 promptly, like those that were able to access the funds early on, which were unfortunately not as likely to be the smallest small businesses, that, you know, the vast majority of businesses of color are, 95% are owner, non-employee based firms.
Gotcha.
And so, and that is true of white owned businesses as well. 78% of white owned businesses are non-employee firms. But businesses of color, you know, put another way, are 81% less likely than white-owned businesses to not to have any employees.
Well, yes. Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. Do you think, because I've heard some critics say perhaps even with the rollout, maybe the rollout process should have been tiered, starting with the really small business owners and then those that might have been just sole proprietorships?
Yes. There are a number of ways that the program could be structured to better encourage lenders to actually make small loans to the smallest of businesses. So the PPP fee structure, for example, heavily discourages small loans to smaller businesses, which are more likely to be businesses owned by people of color. Basically, businesses that are more resourced were advantaged by the structure of the program in lots of ways. So larger payrolls make you eligible for larger roles, having existing relationships with financial institutions and commercial lenders. All of these are huge advantages. So there are a number of ways in which the program is structurally disadvantaged for the smallest of small businesses.
So you think that was intentional or unintentional?
Well, I don't know if it was intentional or not intentional, but we know that there are structural problems with the program and that there are ways to address those. So you've named some ideas of how you might address those. We have others, including changing the fee structure and reserving money for CDFIs, community development financial institutions, and MDIs, minority depository institutions, that we know have a track record of better serving communities of color. So, you know, reserving money, which is something we asked for in round two, didn't happen. There was a reserve for smaller financial institutions overall, those that have between $10 and $50 billion. Just because it's a smaller financial institution doesn't necessarily mean it's serving communities of color well. In fact, we've seen in the past that hasn't been the case, but we do know that CDFIs and MDIs have a track record of serving businesses of color. And so setting aside money for those is something that we've asked for. It's something we're asking for moving forward. And it's also just important to note that we know very little about this program and who it's serving. We don't have precise geographic data, and we don't have demographic data. So one thing that we're asking for, and for money that is yet to be dispersed, and also there are ways to make it possible for money that's already been dispersed. The SBA has not collected data, optional demographic data, and that is something that we want to see the SBA do moving forward. So, you know, the loans that have already been dispersed, because this is a loan program that actually is going to be turned into grants. They're forgivable loans that are essentially going to be grants for the vast majority of these businesses if the money is spent the way it was intended. They are going to be applying for loan forgiveness. And we want the SBA to ask for demographic data in those loan forgiveness applications. And then also as they continue this PPP program or something similar moving forward, because we don't have any transparency about this program. And in order to, you know what's happening and for there to be appropriate oversight and accountability and to be able to make changes to better serve the communities that Congress intended to be served. Ultimately, they wanted, you know, underserved and rural communities to be served. And it's good for the economy and an important lifeline for these businesses. We need that data.
In this report from the SBA's Inspector General, I'm going to pull a quote here. Because SBA did not provide guidance to lenders about prioritizing borrowers in underserved and rural markets, these borrowers, including rural, minority, and women-owned businesses, may not have received loans as intended. That pretty much summarizes everything you just said, Yasmin.
Yes, absolutely. What we want is for the SBA to provide guidance, because we do want a reserve for CDFIs and MDIs, but we also want there to be guidance and structural changes to help other larger, more mainstream financial institutions also serve these communities, because that is going to be necessary to make sure that the funds are distributed equitably and fairly.
There was something also that, and this is, will jump out, and obviously it might be alarming to some people, but per that report, 91% of Latino-owned businesses, 91% of Native Hawaiian or Pacific Islander-owned businesses, 75% of Asian-owned businesses stand close to no chance of receiving a PPP loan through a mainstream bank or credit union, close quote. And I want to focus on that, the latter there, which is the credit unions, because for so many people, they feel like the credit union has always been that community, that small business, that mom and pop friendly oriented lending institution. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, the vast majority of the funds kind of flew out the door very quickly through these mainstream larger financial institutions. We don't unfortunately have data to show what, as I said, who exactly is being served by credit unions, for example. Mm-hmm. We do know that certain institutions have a better track record of serving those communities, but really those numbers just represent the existing data is, and there's not a whole lot of existing data using Census Bureau data and SBA analysis from the past about the number of businesses that are this kind of smallest of small businesses that are non-employer businesses. Or we also know that businesses of color just on average have fewer employees. The loans they would be eligible for are smaller. You know, the allowable loan size is determined by the size of the business's monthly payroll. Mm-hmm. And the structure of the program, the fee structure, disincentivizes making small loans. So your average loan in the first round of funding, what we do know is that the average loan was around $200,000. For these small non-employer businesses, and businesses that don't have very many employees, you're not eligible for a $200,000 loan. So mm-hmm. we know just from the average loan size that it wasn't serving as many of these small businesses that really it could make the difference between them staying afloat and not just being able to get that money and get it early. So we want to see changes moving forward that help incentivize all financial institutions to make these smaller loans to small businesses. But what's already happened in the first round, those who lost out, you know, they suffered damage. That's already done. Mm-hmm. And once you get behind on commercial rent, you start incurring late fees, those kinds of things. It just becomes more and more costly. And so we, of course, want to see changes moving forward. And we do have recommendations about the change in the fee structure that could help that, you know, a minimum origination fee. Because if you're getting an origination fee of, say, 5%, on a $200,000 loan mm-hmm. versus a $10,000 loan, one of those loans, any financial institution is disincentivized to make.
Absolutely. The voice you hear is Yasmin Ferrari. She's a senior policy counsel for the Center for Responsible Lending, a nonprofit policy group based in Durham, North Carolina. You were getting into solutions. And then this was very interesting, to help small businesses access the program, because before you can even get to the application, just accessing the program, we're going to start with that. What are those solutions you see to modify or change that process?
Well, if you don't already have an existing financial relationship, obviously it was going to take longer and you don't have kind of people on staff that can help with these things. It was going to take longer and to understand this process and access the funds. So we need to give funding to, you know, groups like CDFIs and MDIs that we know do prioritize communities of color. But we also need to issue guidance. And this is what the SBA is kind of being asked to do and mm-hmm. expected to do to mainstream banks and credit unions to so that it helps them better serve businesses of color and get them access to these funds. And then, of course, at a minimum, you know, I just want to emphasize that transparency is essential in all of this. So the SBA must collect and analyze data to show where the money is going. So corrective measures can be taken to avoid leaving out communities who need the support the most.
And it would be interesting if there was some type of data to reflect, even if just by zip code. I think that might give an indication as well. How optimistic are you that that will happen, that the SBA will collect that type of information?
I'm not going to make a prediction about how likely that is to happen, but I know various organizations beyond, you know, consumer advocacy groups, of course, we are asking for more precise geographic data. And I know that other organizations are around the country, news organizations and others are asking for more transparency around this program. This is a huge taxpayer money, and taxpayers have the right to know what's happening with this money. Now, this program was essential. You know, I think policymakers rightly made the judgment that it's better for the economy as a whole for individuals to be attached to their businesses, to keep these businesses going so that people who've worked hard for many years, you know, don't have to rebuild everything again. So it was a necessary use of taxpayer money to keep the economy going. But we just want to make sure that whole communities are not, you know, effectively left out.
And finally, lenders were very critical too, because lenders said, you know, we were not given enough guidelines. When folks mm-hmm. went to the web portals, they weren't working. So to be fair, a lot of lenders, a lot of institutions says we were kind of just hung out here and we didn't have all the information we needed. So mm-hmm. just wanted to, you know, felt that we should note that as well.
And, you know, the SBA needs to provide more guidance to these institutions to help them better serve these communities and change the structure to minimize the disincentive for serving the smallest of businesses.
After this next funding round, if there are the same problems, and I hate to ask you to look through your crystal ball here, your small business mm-hmm. crystal ball here, but could we see a huge number of small businesses either shutter for good or leave the communities that they've been in?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what we're concerned about. We're worried about how that may be has already happened in a way that really disadvantages communities of color. Because, like I said, getting money promptly at the beginning of this crisis for some of these small businesses, when they had payments still to make on their commercial rents, on their equipment, on those kinds of things, you know, we are really concerned that those who lost out and suffered damage, that's damage that has been done and that will cause permanent setbacks. Mm-hmm. And of course, we continue to be worried about that moving forward and are concerned about the impact that this program, if changes are not made, will continue to have on the widening racial wealth gap.
Yasmin Ferrari, Senior Policy Counsel for the Center for Responsible Lending, a nonprofit policy group based in Durham, North Carolina. Yasmin, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Good conversation.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Grace Walker and LaShawn Hudson. Our engineer is Shelley Canavy. If you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 8 p.m. and listen whenever you want, because Closer Look is now available as a podcast. Just visit NPR One or your favorite streaming app and subscribe. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. This is Closer Look, and I am Rose Scott, and we are fundraising today, but this spring we're doing it a little differently, and we'll keep these breaks as short as possible. Please, if you can, help us at wabe.org/donate. Joining me is someone with the perfect public radio name, J.Ann Berry, WABE's Marketing Director.
WABE.org/donate is where you can go to give or call 678-553-9090. Hi, I want you to know that your donation right now helps pay for all the critical news and information you get on WABE. And today, we're partnering with St. Vincent de Paul, Georgia, to help low-income essential workers. Here's how that works. Every donation we get today from listeners like you will pay for 1 week of transportation assistance to an essential worker. To make that happen, give right now at wabe.org/donate or call 678-553-9090. Help WABE and help an essential worker during this challenging time.
That's wabe.org/donate or just call 678-553-9090. 9090. Thanks to listeners who've already made their donation. Folks like Kelly O'Neill in Marietta. She says, thank you all for continuing this vital programming during these difficult and unprecedented times. We are grateful. Well, Kelly, we're grateful for you, and we're grateful that Kelly is a WABE member. Now it's your turn. We can only provide this type of programming because of donations from listeners like you. So please give at wabe.org/donate.
Or call 678-553-9090. It's important that we hear from you right now because 84%, that's a big chunk, of our funding comes from the Atlanta community. Many of our listeners typically give $15 a month, but please give what you feel you can afford. Do it at wabe.org/donate or with a call to 678-553-9090.
Thank you so much to everyone who's helped us so far during the drive, but we need you too. Please give right now at 678-553-9090.
Or at wabe.org/donate. If you donate online, you'll get to see all of the great thank you gifts we offer to members. It only takes a couple of minutes to give. And if you're already a sustaining member of WABE, thank you. And please consider giving an additional gift. We need you, Atlanta. Go to wabe.org/donate or call 678-553-9090. Thank you so much.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now plugged in, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.